You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm speaking to a very powerful comic presence indeed. A very funny lady, a South African by birth. She has moved and naturalised in New Zealand. I think naturalised is the word. She's got herself a passport. That's what it's all about. This is the fantastically funny Ursula Carlson.
You are presumably now, which, how many times have you done this festival?
This is my fourth time.
Your fourth.
Yeah.
And you are commanding an audience. What, I was in your room the other night, what is it, like 400-seater?
Yeah, 400-seater, and I think they allow for like 100 walk-ups.
Okay, and you're so, filling it every night for a 10-night run.
Yeah.
So you're kind of having a pretty banging festival, right?
Yeah, man.
So does this mean you can put the best hotel in Christchurch on your contract?
No, they just get, what I say, and this is the God's honest truth, the first year I came, we stayed in this place that had bed bugs, but then they got rid of it, like after like 10,000 bites, they kind of got the fumigators in one day, they said just leave all your stuff, we'll wash it, and then they got the fumigators, but, and it's really old, like it's very dated, 1970s kind of place, but it had a kitchenette and a great swimming pool. And because it's summer, so we say to them every year, we go, can we go back to that place? And now, actually, the festival's gone. It's a bit munty. We don't want to.
You've been subtly manipulating.
Yeah, we go, please put us back in the shithole. And they go, no, we want to give it. But so they just moved us literally a block away from where we were. Same kind of scenario, a little bit dated, but instead of the 70s, it's sort of the 80s, but it's got a pool and a kitchenette, so.
Very nice.
Yeah, because I can't, like, people think it's all fun and games when you have restaurant food every day, but it's like, oh, it just does my head in. I need to cook, you know, so I say to them, just give us a place where I can just do some cooking, yes. And, you know.
Are you the only comic who has been back for those last 4 years that you've done this? Because you seem a real sort of fixture of the festival.
No, actually, that's sort of still a newbie compared, because some people like Jeremy Elwood, Michelle Accord, those guys have been back like 8, 9, 12 times.
Yeah, yeah. And as Derek Flores was saying last night, it used to be a buskers festival.
Yeah.
Now the stand-ups have moved in and taken all the best venues.
Yeah, because it's just people have just gone, oh, what do we do at night? Mm-hmm. So it just kind of gives the festival, I guess, that opportunity to get a big marquee that seats 800 people and chuck some comics in there. I mean, we'll do it for anything, won't we?
I mean, you must be a big fan of New Zealand because you live here now. When did you move here?
2006, 8 years ago.
Okay. Now, listen, is it fair to say you're a celebrity in New Zealand?
I don't think New Zealand has celebrities because I think we're too small. I say I'm well known. People know of me in New Zealand, yes.
Okay. And presumably then you've done a lot of interviews, you've done a lot of this is my life story, this is where I'm from. I get the impression, and it's not from anything you've said, but I'm just looking around at your online presence, it seems quite a kind of a measured, dynamic online presence whereby you've obviously got great PR, you've done kind of the Woman's Weekly type interviews and talked about kids and stuff.
No, that's the thing. That's the thing. Like, I do a lot of interviews, but I don't really reveal a lot. Like, I don't talk about my personal life ever. So I've done Women's Day interviews and Women's Weekly, and I'm actually a columnist for Women's Weekly. And people go, do you talk about your kid? I go, no, I don't. Like, very few people know I have a kid. Very few people know anything about my private life because I just feel... I fell into this career, but this is my responsibility. And my family didn't sign up for any of this. So I always make sure if I do an interview, I never put them in the limelight or I never say anything about them because, like, even with my kid, I don't want her, say if she's 16 or something, you don't know what they turn into. What if she's shy? Mm-hmm. And then she goes, I can't believe you did all of this, mm-hmm. or, you know, like, so I would never do that.
Go on.
I totally push my career or... You know, because if they want to have an interview, I go, yeah, I've got this festival coming up or I've got this TV show that's launching. So I totally use it for that.
Mm.
As long as they're happy with what they get and I'm happy with what I get, it's a win-win both ways, isn't it?
So give us, for people that don't know you, I know we've got a lot of listeners in the UK. Have you been to the UK?
No, I haven't. Not for comedy. I've been to the UK, but not to do comedy.
Okay. Yeah. So if the majority of my listeners are in the UK, just give us a quick... Do the life story in 30 seconds. So we do. And I'm sure you could do this. This is a radio show. Yeah. We're here with Ursula Carlson, who's got 45 seconds to tell us her incredible life story.
Okay, I was born in South Africa, the biggest baby that was ever born in this particular hospital in Johannesburg. Lived in South Africa. We had a game farm. It was good fun. Lying in the carport, read up on that. And then moved over to New Zealand in 2006. Best decision of my life. Got married. Have a kid. Fell into comedy 5 years ago.
Okay.
Only while living in New Zealand.
I see. Yeah. I didn't know that. I thought that you were a comic in South Africa. Okay.
No, I used to work in the newspaper industry in South Africa.
In the what industry?
Newspaper industry.
Oh, right, okay.
I didn't even know that comedy was a thing. I didn't think you could, like... Before my first gig, I'd never even been to comedy.
Yes.
I didn't know it was a thing.
You listen to the podcast, you know I'm fond of referring to people's origin stories. Yeah. Yours is, you're one of those people, like, it's such a beautiful kind of soundbite that it makes me go, oh, come on, that can't be true.
Yeah.
Like, you got given a fake, like, contract. A leaving present that was, go on, what is
okay,
this?
Okay, so because I worked for Ogilvy, an ad agency, and then I went to another agency, and as a leaving gift, they gave me this cheap coffee maker and a fake contract to go to an open mic night because the people we worked in these little pods, like a copywriter and a designer and a photo retoucher and whatever, and we always had a good laugh and they go, you should go do comedy. And I said, you're out of your mind. And then they gave me this fake contract and made me sign it in front of everyone and I thought, oh, I'll get out of it. But they'd already booked it in.
No way. So, and this isn't a thing you can buy in the shops as like a joke present.
No,
this
no,
is
no. They made it up.
Your creative friends going, right, let's force you
this. This is my creative
stay.
Friends that made a certificate.
Okay.
And then they made me sign it, this little gift
certificate. So they effectively staged an intervention to turn you into a comedian.
Yes. And I was like, I don't want to do it. And they go, well, we've already booked you in. You have to go do 5 minutes. What's 5 minutes? And we've booked for 70 of us to go. And I was like, oh. So then I thought, because I was still pretty new in the country, I didn't want to look like a dick. So I said, all right, I'll go do it. So I went, did it, had a beer afterwards, good fun,
What was the gig?
It was just open mic night. It was on St. Patrick's Day in 2008.
Okay.
And I walked out on stage and, I mean, I had no idea what stand-up comedy was, you know, sort of. I mean, I've heard, like, you know, listened to DVDs and stuff, but I'd never been to a live show. I didn't know how it worked. I just kind of walked out, and because it was St. Patrick's Day, everyone was dressed in green. And I just went, holy shit, I can't do that. I look like Shrek. And then people were laughing. I'm like, what? And then, you know, like, and so I sort of just talked to them for 5 minutes. I had written down some stuff, which I then said, and they laughed at that too. So I was like, of course they laughed. I know 70 people in the audience.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay.
So when I left the next morning, I got a call from the owner of the club, Scott, and he goes...
This was the Classic.
At the Classic in Queen Street in Auckland. I go, and then he phones and he says, you're through to the next round. I said, what are you talking about? He says, it's RawQuest, where with every comedy festival they look for new talent. And apparently this was in the competition, but we didn't know. It was just a piss take at work. So I go, oh, I'm not interested in that, mate. Give it to somebody else that wants to do it. I've already got a job. Like, I'm nailing life as it is.
Yeah.
I've got. And he goes, no, but it was, like, people were laughing. I go, I said, people were laughing because I knew the majority of your audience. He goes, I was in there. I was laughing. You don't know me. Uh-huh. And I thought, okay. And he says, come back. Do it again. Don't tell anyone. So I just went back, didn't tell anyone, did it again.
So Scott Blank's created you.
Basically.
He forced you. The intervention created
you.
Yeah,
it's like everyone was sort of in on it without knowing.
That's so lovely.
Yeah, but by then I was hooked. I was like, oh, yeah. And then a year after my first gig, I had to quit my job because comedy was just taking over. It was amazing. My boss went, choose, comedy or advertising. Well, we're not having a podcast about advertising, are we?
No, we can get into the differences between them because, we all know that that if you boil it right down, we're all advertising beer. That's what it means. Effectively, that's how the economics work.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about that first gig.
Yeah.
What do you remember? What jokes you taken on stage? What did you write?
Yes. Okay. My first joke that I ever did was about silent treatment. It's actually on YouTube. Was about how because I'm a Lesbian, so I've got a girlfriend, and I go out. I said, people always say you're so lucky that you have a girlfriend at home because boys are such dickheads, and I go, it's not all Ikoya candles and cinnamon buns, because women, we have problems, and we all excel at silent treatment. And, my girlfriend and I haven't spoken since 2004. And just stuff like that. And then, of course, the Shrek thing and how I don't suffer from low self-esteem, but as a child I had to be cut out of a hula hoop. And so just this whole, sort of everything. It was just all about me and what I look like and sort of my relationship, stuff like that, that I thought would be safe to talk about because I didn't want to offend anyone. So
did you think that was a risk that you might?
Yeah, I was scared because people at work would go, all you do, you see who's in the front row and you just take the piss out of them.
Okay.
And I thought, oh, I don't want to do that.
Okay.
Because I remember, and I think this is why I never went to a comedy show. When we were little, my mum went to a comedy show and she got picked on. She sat in the front and she's never been back to a comedy show until I started doing comedy.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah. So if I do a solo show, I always say to audience, I don't pick on my audience because they come to see a show, not be the show.
Mm.
So that's why you have to really be out of control for me to intervene and put you in your place.
Yes.
Like if you heckle or something, then I'll put you in your place. But I won't go out of my way if I see somebody in the audience with anything. I won't pick on it.
I had one in the comedy show here 2 nights ago. There was a guy in the front row who was on his own. He had an open chair next to him, and I thought his girlfriend was coming back from the bar, or his friend was coming back from the bar. Yeah. And I said, so are you out on your own tonight? And I don't know why I said that. This was an empty space. And he went, yeah. And I had to really quickly go, I'm not going to do jokes about this. And I immediately, good man, he's come out on his own, give him a round of applause, and then move on. Because the idea of bullying someone, that's when it feels like it's the sharp end of...
Yeah.
People think that they get picked on, and comedians all go, oh, it's not really picking on them.
Yeah.
But we're used to the attention, we're used to the gaze of everyone, and people aren't used to it and they don't want it.
Exactly, and that would have been his number one fear coming out. He would have tossed up in the car going, should I go in... If they see I'm by myself, so that would have been a thing for him. So if he had picked on her, he would have gone, oh, my God, I shouldn't have. And he'll never do it again. But if you just let it go, then he'll go, no, it was safe. I can do that,
I hope so.
Because I always say you never know the people's backstory. Like they come out or say somebody's got a wonky eye or whatever and you go, holy shit, you've got a wonky eye. And then you do a bit about it and it's a cheap laugh, because people, A, can't even see that person.
Mm-hmm. And B, it's heightened. The response is heightened because it's immediate. You don't need to be clever.
Yeah.
You just need to say what you see, don't you?
Exactly. So then you get a cheap laugh out of it and that guy leaves and feels terrible. You've ruined comedy for that guy, live comedy. That guy will potentially never come back. So I don't do that. I don't like that.
So given your kind of rise, that's meteoric, isn't it? From getting forced into a gig, getting the promoter ring you up and insisting you go back to quitting your job a year later.
Yeah.
What is it that you think you've got that is responsible for that?
I don't know. I think, or I kind of hope, it's because I'm quite approachable and people, because people come up to me all the time and they go, can I, like today I went to the mall and I had five hugs before I got to
the
ATM.
We were on our way to the bar last night and some lady stopped you and said, can I hug you? Yeah.
And that was about my 10th one for the day. Like people hug me, they you know, like they're lovely. They just come up and talk to me. And I think that's amazing that, you know, like I like the fact that I'm quite approachable. I like the fact that people just yell out of their cars or come up and talk to me. I haven't had, touch wood, any negative or, you know, like really out of this world negative stuff. Like people don't yell negative stuff at me or, you know, it's rare to get it. I do get it sometimes, like people take the time to write emails or whatever, but it's rare. So I think that and I try and keep this my material fresh, like I write a lot. So people, like I've got, like boomerang crowds, they come every year.
Yes.
So it's my responsibility to give them something new every year. Like I don't want to do half of the show that's old stuff and half new. I give them a new show every year. And I think people appreciate that and they sort of, because every year the stuff that I write, I still stick with what's personal, stuff I know, you know. So I think, like, it's almost like chapters in a book. Every year they come back, they learn something new or they hear something new or, you know, it's not all deep and meaningful.
I want to get onto the material in a minute, but I just want to stick for the minute with your persona on stage and with your personality. Do you feel that you are a naturally funny person? Or do you feel that you're naturally likeable and you're bringing your jokes up to the level of how much they like you? Do you see what I mean?
Well, I think I'm naturally funny because if I just have a conversation, and I think that's why I got into comedy, because we would just talk and then people would laugh. And it's sort of that contagious thing. The more they laugh, the more you want to be funny, you know. So it's sort of
absolutely. I mean, that absolutely genuinely happened to me just then. Yeah. There's something so twinkly about you and there's something so warm that I just want to be laughing in your presence.
See, so that's great. So then the more you get the laughter, the more you want to sort of build on that, and then before you know it, you're just in this riot thing where people go, stop, I'm going to pee my pants, you know, so I don't know, I think it's just, because the stage persona thing, I don't think, like, to me, it's a survival thing, because I get really bad stage fright before I go on.
Okay, so that surprises me, go on.
Yeah, I'm really bad, like, I basically stand side of stage trying to talk myself in, but also out of going on stage. Like, I'll go, why am I doing this? I could go back to my old job and, you know, because I get really petrified. But then once I'm on stage, it's like, I just take a deep breath and I don't think I put on, like, I don't give them a show. I try just to chat to them like you would to if you were just at someone's house having dinner or something and you just chat to them.
Yes, just try to be as non-performative, just trying to be as Fred, like a host at a party sort of thing.
Yeah, like I'm just having a conversation with my audience. So I would do the same, I think, if there was two of them or 500 of them. I just, because I think then people sort of feel like, I'm just talking to you. And in my mind, I am just talking to one of you and then to the next one and then to, so, and I, because that way I feel less overwhelmed. Because I think initially when I just started doing it, because realistically I've only been doing it properly for 3 years, where I've gone, all right, because the whole time it's like, should I stick with advertising or should it be comedy? Mm. Like I couldn't really decide. I was sort of petrified to take the big leap, you know. And then I thought, well, you can't ride two horses with one ass, can you? So you have to kind of choose. And then when I fully committed to comedy, it kind of went from doing little 80-seater basement rooms to doing big theatre kind of, you know. And so for somebody that has stage fright, that is quite a bit of a, it's almost like a punch in the gut, you know. Like,
yes.
Like you go, I can handle
people
the 80s.
People keep forcing me to do comedy and then to do bigger audiences.
Yeah, like literally this is the conversation I have with my manager every year after the comedy festival. She'll go, next year we have to go to a bigger venue because every year you have to do extra shows or extra. I go, no, let's stick with this. We know we can do this room. Like I know I can do a 400 or I know I can do a 500. She goes, no, but next year we'll do a 700. I'm like, no. And then she'll just sign me up for it.
And when you're, I suppose when I hear my contemporaries having those kind of conversations about, oh, I don't know if I want to go up another 200 seats. Yeah. I suppose I always assume that they're meaning that from the point of view of, I don't know if I can sell that many seats. Yeah. But you actually, it seems like you're saying it from the point of view of, you don't know if you can play that many seats.
Yeah, because it scares the hell out of me to see all of those faces when you walk out. But then I think, and I always say it at the beginning, I'm not going to pick on you. And I think if you reassure them, and because I have so many people that'll come back, they sort of know, like, even if I say now, I won't pick on you, some people in the front go to their friends, nah, she won't. Like, they sort of, you know, they go, oh, I've been here before, she doesn't. You're good. And when I see how relaxed they are, because I think the nervous thing for me is, because you know how they say the number one fear is public speaking, but when you walk out and you look at your audience and you see how petrified they are, because people are scared to sit in the front at a comedy show. So you're scared, and you look at them and they're scared. So it's not there's not a comfortable, those first few seconds on stage is not comfortable. Mm. You're sort of assessing each other. It's almost like when you're faced with a snake out in the wild, you sort of assess each other and go, who's going to go first, you know? But it's your job as the comedian, as the professional, to go, we're all going to be all right, without actually saying that. That's what it's like for me.
Who are your contemporaries? Who are your other female contemporaries? And I'm not suggesting for a minute that female comedy is a genre,
yeah.
But I know you've won the New Zealand Comedy Guild Best Female Comic for the last 4 years.
5 years.
Five years. Yeah. That's presumably going to start getting embarrassing, is it? Do you, when you see other female comics in New Zealand?
No, oh, because...
Me again, I'm best.
No, because I think... that's why I said to you, I don't think there's celebrities in New Zealand, because we're so small, and it's more a community than a, you know, because we all work together all the time, you know, like you would know, you sort of work with the same people, and it is really supportive. It's not, so, because I've known all of them, you know, from the get-go, and it's Justine Smith, Michelle Acourt, Irene Pink, Rose Mottafei, all those guys. And, like, they get nominated every year. And it's sort of, honestly, it could be any one of us. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I don't get it,
Five years in a row.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why do you think that is? I just want to try and get to the bottom of this. You possess some kind of quality that makes you... funnier, do you think, or more clasped to the bosom of your audience?
No, do you know what I think it is? I think it's basically just brand recognition, and because I do a lot of festivals and I do TV and I do some radio and I write a column and I'm not just in the one genre. I don't just stick to the one thing. I sort of have my finger in many pies, because I think it comes back to that being petrified of not having a real job,
yes.
You know. So,
and presumably, having worked in advertising,
yeah.
You understand how to manage your own brand.
Yes. So, so then I think when people think female comic, they go, "Who's that one on the radio? Who's that one?" So I'm sort of everywhere. So it's almost like Coca-Cola. When you think soft drink, you go, "It's Coca-Cola." What, you know? So you sort of start with the ones that you just see a lot of. But also, Coke is the drink that most people get sick of. it's a balance.
Well,
it's a
form. Well, how do you make those decisions about, do you ever, or have you so far found yourself going, I'm getting overexposed?
Yeah, I've said no to a lot of things where I go, I could do that, I could risk taking that, you know, and just go for the money and be, you know, sort of all over something. Or I could go, no thanks, and still have 4 or 5 years in sort of that field where you slowly expose just a little bit of yourself. So, yeah, I say no to a lot of things if I go, I don't think it's good for me. And I'm in the lucky position where I've got a great manager and we're sort of on the same page, and we sit down like once a year and make a year plan, a 2-year plan, 5-year plan, because I'm all about pre-planning, you know, a bit of a control freak, but... And we know, like, she'll phone me up, she goes, we've got this offer that came in, and both of us will just go, no. She'll go, good. Well, I have to check. You know, I have to check if you're on board or whatever. But no, like, okay. I think you have to be clever, not just go for the money or for, you know, you have to be clever and say, well, I can take the money now and be out of this game. And because who knows? You know, it's not like if I was an accountant, I know I'd retire at 65, maybe 67, and boom, this is my plan.
Yeah.
But this is entertainment, so it's like, how long does it last? You know, so you need to future proof.
Yes.
So
yes.
That's what I'm trying to do.
So this is Ursula. As you can hear, this was recorded at the Christchurch World Buskers Festival. Ursula's great. You know, she's a really fun lady. I love the fact that she listens to the podcast. That always flatters my ego enormously. And I think she's just got some really good stuff to say about the whole process and that whole way by which one becomes. And again, I don't want to say every man because it's an inherently sexist topic, but is there an equivalent phrase, every person? That quality whereby you go, oh, where huge numbers of people go, oh, you're just like me. I relate to this. I relate to you. So that's a really fascinating element of her comedy. So thank you very much to Ursula for her time. Thanks for listening and thanks for your donations. I'm really, really appreciating your donations. You too can be part of the crowd of cool kids that like to give money to the podcast. Simply go to comedianscomedian.com and you can choose your own donation amount. Simply click on the very visible, very obvious and clearly visible PayPal button at comedianscomedian.com. So click on that and you can decide what to give me. £1 a show, 50p a show, £20 a show, a one-off donation of £20, or a really big belly-bustering one if you'd like to do more than that. Thanks to everyone that's been donating. I really appreciate it, and I promise I don't fritter that money away. I only spend it on new equipment for the show, new routes to take the show, work on the website, work on PR, all the things I can do to make the show bigger and better and more inclusive and all of those things. So that's very much appreciated. I very much appreciate it, and as do all of the other listeners, as well as you, because we are one big, happy, tragic family. That's all for now. Tweet me at ComComPod. Email me info@comedianscomedian.com, and I will speak to you again at the end of this bit. Let's get back to the brilliant Ursula Carr.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Awesome.
So talking then about the material, which number hour is this for you? How many hours have you got under your belt?
I think 5 or 6 English shows and 2 Afrikaans shows.
So you speak Afrikaans and perform in Africa. Do you go back to South Africa?
No. You do them
over here? You do them for expat South Africans?
I've done Afrikaans shows in Melbourne, Perth, Wellington and Auckland. So 2 in Australia, 2 in New Zealand.
And what's the difference between writing those? Are you doing the same material?
No, it's completely different shows. Completely different shows, because writing in Afrikaans is sort of, it's so much easier, because all my references are just to the expat crowds. It's almost like making jokes with your brother. You know, you can say something like snot bubble, And your brother will just lose it, and everyone else will go, what's wrong with you? But you know, when you guys were 7 and 9, your mother laughed till a small bubble popped out in church, that kind of thing, you know. So it's the same thing with South Africans. You just go, and people start laughing, or, you know, anything like that. So it's a much easier audience to write for.
And do you have a different relationship to them? Because I know the way, certainly your brand positioning over here, if you like, is she loved it so much, she moved here. It's like I bought the company thing, you know. That's obviously, you're hugely endearing, and it reflects your natural warmth really well. But how do you position yourself to South African expats?
Same thing. I just go, I live here now.
I'm one of you. We all moved.
Yeah.
Could you give us your opening line in Afrikaans?
Oh, it's kind of difficult. It's weird. It's like...
I'd like to hear it. I don't know the language at all.
I'm just trying to think, like, what I would say. So that sort of puts me on the spot. Can we get back to that?
That's okay. Yeah. You can get back to it. Or you can think about it for 30 seconds and we'll edit the gap out.
Yeah. You just think. Okay, this is what I'll say to a South African audience when I start. Hallo, welkom by die vertoning. Hier is die land van teelepels en extra suiker en teesakkies. Dis hoekom ons hier bly.
Okay, and what does that mean?
Okay, so that basically means, hi, this is the country of tea bags, sugar and extra teaspoons. Because that's sort of the thing that is, very expensive in South Africa.
Yeah.
That always, when you go to people, you go... like, that's the thing people would come borrow from you. Like, that's our thing.
Okay.
Sugar, tea, like, everything you need to make a cup of tea.
So this is, it's a whole separate kind of...
Yeah.
Well, obviously it's a whole different culture, a whole different continent.
Yeah.
And everything, But it's like a world within the world that you're doing observational comedy within that. That's fascinating. Yeah.
And because you can take the piss out of them, because the people living here, you know, like, a lot of people immigrate over and then they last maybe 6 months and they go back to South Africa.
Okay.
And then you go, why did they go back? Or they miss the help, you know, like, because, they have to clean their own homes and, you know, do their own lawns and stuff. And it's such a foreign concept now. And once you've been out for like a few months, you're like, you can't even think that somebody else will come and do all of that stuff for you. Whereas some people come over and they can't get over the fact that they now have to do stuff for themselves because it's so ingrained in us as a society that somebody else will do it. You know, so sort of that's why it's easy to take the piss out of the ones because you go, well, we're here now. Of course, you all iron your own jeans.
Yeah.
So, because all South Africans iron jeans. That's the thing. I can spot a South African walking in the street because the woman will always have their hair blow dried.
Okay.
Always. The woman will have their hair blow dried and their husbands will have their jeans, their denims ironed. And you go, that's a South African couple. It's just, that's what they do.
So, we're getting onto the topic of observational comedy here. Yeah. So that great, you know, lovely observation, which to me is completely fresh.
Nothing.
And kind of, you know, no idea. Wouldn't have spotted it in a million years. So have you always noticed things in that way? Have you always had, like, pre-comedy? Have you always had a sort of a... Were you making your siblings laugh or your friends laugh by pointing out the way the world is?
Yeah.
Because you're incredibly natural at sort of doing that.
Yeah, I think, because I went to boarding school.
Okay.
In high school, very nice boarding school. But we'd all sit in study hall or dining hall. You know, you do everything together. It's a massive boarding school, like 1,500 kids in the school. And, you know, to do everything together with everyone that's sort of an age range 5 years around you, you know. So it's like the opportunity to make friends, to just have a great time is amazing because everyone's sort of in the same zone as you. So, and then you'd see the teachers walk past or, you know, so it's nice to kind of go, look at that, you know, and just make, because you're not allowed to laugh in study hall. It's silence. You have to. So it's almost like working in a library and you have two prefects just watching you that you keep quiet and do your homework. So it was always a great challenge for me to see who I can crack and study hall, you know, who I can get to just lose it and go into detention by just either not saying anything, just pulling phrases or pointing stuff with my eyes or whatever, just to get them to start laughing, because then it's like laughing in church. You don't want to, but you can't stop. And then...
I mean, that's to me, as someone who went to a very authoritarian school that I did not enjoy one bit, that to me is like, God, I wish I'd either had that quality or treated it like that or thought of doing that. I mean, I had a laugh some of the time, I'm sure. I don't remember it well. But, that's... So is your life, yeah, and has your life always been just laughs?
Yeah, I think so. I'm from a long line of people that just take the piss out of everything. My brother used to say to me, because he's the funniest dude I know, and he used to say to me all the time, like, if you're in any situation, you have the opportunity to, you know, just be all serious, or you can look around and go, these people, because it doesn't matter where you are, like, if you're at a comedy show, if you're in the bank, if you're at the supermarket, everyone around you is at that moment in exactly the same position that you are. Because I went through a phase when I was about 10, 11 years old, where I'd go, if I'm in somewhere, you know, like, say if you go into the dollar shop, or what, you go, oh, what if somebody sees me in you? Or, you know, like, you think other people think badly of you or whatever. I think it's normal, that teenage sort of, when you just enter into that teenage phase. And my brother one day said to me, like, just as I got into that, thank God we had this talk, he goes, it doesn't matter. He says, it doesn't matter what you do, because the people around you at any that stage is doing exactly what you're doing. They're in exactly the same situation that you're in. So if you're in the supermarket, or you're, all of those people need to buy food, so at that time you're in the perfect position, because they all, so you can be friendly, you can be, you go, I'm doing exactly what you're doing.
That's very interesting, seen in the, yeah, in the paradigm of your stand-up.
Yeah,
it's all about saying we're all the same.
Yeah,
we're all doing this.
Yeah, and that's why even when I get really nervous, I'm like, we're all, so when I usually,
we're all
say
nervous.
I always, yeah, say to my audience, we're like a little community, we're in this for the next hour. It's me and you, you know, regardless how this thing turns out, we're all going to have the same story, or, you know, sort of the same thing at the end of it, where, you know, you go, well, I was just there. I just
And
did
does that.
That
ever, does that ever not work? Do you have bad gigs? Do you have times when you don't manage to catch the feeling of the room?
Yeah, of course. I mean, everyone has bad gigs, and sometimes, like, especially if I don't get a hold of the stage fright by the time I have to go on, and I'm a bit panicky, or I'm a bit, you know, whatever it comes across as, because I think whatever you are, if you're tired, your audience will get tired, because they pick up on whatever you have. If you're up, they'll be up. If you're nervous and skittish, they'll go, you know, because it's almost like if you get in a plane and you're waiting and the pilot gets on and he looks real nervous, fidgeting, you're going to go, oh, shit, we're in deep trouble now.
That's a good analogy. Yeah,
so that's sort of, if the pilot gets on, I've got this. You're going to go, he's got this, guys.
So if you're on stage and you haven't got it,
yeah,
can you get it?
I have been able to get it occasionally, where I go, okay, this is not working. But see, I believe in total honesty with my audience. If it's not working, I'll go, yeah, it's not really working. You guys aren't into that. Let's try this one. And then I'll bring out some, like, A grade that I know will get a good laugh, and then just sort of, or I'll just start talking to somebody, sure, or, you know, just doing some observational stuff. So my biggest thing, crutch, really, if it's not going well, is to stop, take a deep breath and just go, all right, that bit's not working, or I'm freaking out. Just take a deep breath. I'll have a sip of water, go, I'm a bit parched, and just say what I'm doing, you know, like, not saying I'm freaking out, I don't know what's happening, but I'm just going, just need a bit of water, talk amongst yourselves, and just sort of taking a second, and then turn back, and and it really works. Whereas if I just keep freaking out and keep going, keep trying to push, it doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. Which I did that in the beginning.
The reason I mentioned the is your life all laughs thing. We had a very brief conversation last night about the Susan Kalman interview that I did, and about that aspect. And I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about, I don't remember exactly how you phrased it last night, but you were saying hearing her describe her depression.
Yeah.
Well, what was your reaction to that?
Because
episode?
That really helped me sort of to get a grip of, because I don't know anyone, like, no one in my family has depression, or, you know, sort of, I don't have any point of reference. I don't know how it works, how, you know, sort of. But now that I'm in comedy, I know quite a lot of people with depression. It's amazing how many comics have depression. And, you know, and of course, as an adult now, I'm sort of expanding. And you kind of get to know more people with it. And I'm like, I don't even know how it works. Or so listening to that was really a good help. And also, because you think, well, as a comic, I'm funny. Just when I have a chat, my friends always laugh, or, you know, people go, shit, man, you're so funny. But then I think of people with depression, like if you're just not in that zone, how difficult it must be to sit down and write funny stuff, you know, if the last thing you feel like is doing that. So it was quite good, actually.
But you never have that?
No.
And you never... So when you sit down to write,
what,
it all just comes out of you and there it is, bang, there's an hour? How long does it take you to write an hour?
It depends. I'm busy writing one now. I usually use this time in Christchurch, the 2 weeks that I'm here, to write a new show. But what I do is I write with somebody else. Like I'll get my friend Nick Rado, who's also a comic, but our voices are completely different. You know, like he's a young, fit, straight guy. And so we just, we'll sit down for 3 hours. The first hour and a half, we'll go, everything's yours. So then he pulls out his book with all his notes and his mind map, and we just write, and he goes, I've got this thing about this. And I go, okay, well, we can do this. Or we just come up, every gag
that is
that
a
comes,
great rule, by the way. The first 90 minutes, everything's yours.
Everything's yours. If it comes out of my mouth, if it's real funny, it's yours. Like, that's what, and then we take a little break, and the next one is mine. Everything that comes out, he puts all his books away, we do mine, and that's it.
Have you ever squabble over that? Have either of you ever gone, oh, come on, no, that's 1 minute in, which is that thing I said, no. I've got to hold on to it.
No, but what has happened is, like, I'll come up with something for him while we're doing his 90 minutes ago. Oh, just quickly, for your thing, I think we sort of, as an add-on.
Yeah, as
an add-on to something, that'll sound great if you say it. And then,
and what things do you think? You say you've got a very different voice to yours. And Nick's an excellent. I was working at the festival with Nick last year. Excellent comic.
Yeah.
What differences are there in the approach, in the writing approach that you take? Just as a way of kind of hacking into what it is that you do to make stuff funny.
Yeah.
What things are you good at doing for him? And what things is he good at doing with your stuff?
He sees the funny stuff, he writes down the funny, and then he needs to write down the build-up for it, basically.
Okay.
Whereas I don't have the funny yet. I have a story, and then I start writing the story, and then I have to go back and add the funny in.
Okay.
So say if I have a funny story about a giraffe, I write the whole thing down about the giraffe story, then I go, now how can this be funny? It is a factual story, so now I've got that truth element. Now I need to make it funny so people can sort of, you know. So I have to go back and write the funny. So sometimes I was like, I've got this idea. I can probably put that in. Yeah, or you can put, you know, and just like small things. Like you just go, talk about the eyelashes. Oh,
yeah,
giraffes
okay.
have massive eyelashes. So then you sort of, you know. So I just go back and put that in, and then with them I go, oh, you just need the build-up. You've already got the heart part.
And are there aspects of comedy that you feel are out of your reach? Are there things you see other comics doing that you think, I wish I was better at that bit?
Yeah, hell yeah.
Well, what kind of things are we talking
Anything.
About? Because at the moment, people are going to be listening to this going, well, she was just born funny and she's got a great life.
No.
we've got to get some negativity out of this.
I can't do accents. I can't do noises. I'm not good at physical stuff. Like, I just basically stand and talk. I'm literally just that. I stand up. But I have none of the other skills I have, you know. And also, like, I see people interact with audience members and I go, that's not one of my strengths. Like, I can talk to them, but it's not, like, say Nick, again, because he's a great MC, so he's good at just riffing with the audience for, like, half an hour. Whereas I'm like, yeah, I can give you 5 to 7 minutes, but then I want to get back to my material, my safe zone.
And would you like to be able to riff more? Is that a...
Occasionally, yeah. I think it's a strength that I don't have. Like, it's not a... But the only way to get it is to do it more.
I guess you're not in a position now where you need to be bothering spending time riffing. If you've got a show to write for an 800-seater and you're going to do that 20 times, then there's probably not much point doing open spots where you can... talk to the audience for 15
no,
minutes.
No, but I do. I do love a bar gig. I do love a bit of a shit fight.
Yes,
you know. Yeah, I love a tough gig where people go, "It's not great," and go, that's awesome. I love that. I love because I think that's what makes you hardy. As a, you know, where you go in and go, "I can do it," because you need the tough gigs because festivals are easy.
Yeah,
because people come to see you. They already love you. You've already won them over. Whereas if you go into a bar, 90% of the people just want to drink. You know, and then 10% go, who? What? And then you're just standing in the corner doing the show, and I kind of like that. I take sick pleasure out of that. I love it. Yeah, because I think it, because I don't have as many hours under the belt as most comics, you know, sort of at the same level as I am now. So it's like I need to do the terrible gigs and even the daytime sunshine gigs, I go do them because I feel, you know.
What are the daytime gigs?
You know, like if you do a music, I just did music festivals in Australia.
Okay, yes.
But it's during the day. It's like 1 o'clock in the afternoon and the blazing sun when everyone's a bit, you know, music festival-y. And, you know, it's like the toughest comedy gigs. But when you're in a green room and people tell their war stories, you know, you don't want to be the one go, I've actually only done awesome gigs. I don't do terrible bar gigs or daytime gigs. Or I think it sort of shapes you as a comic if you do the hard ones and you sort of make it through the other side.
And what are your tactics for making it through the other side? What are some of the toughest gigs you've had and what did you have to do to make them work?
Just basically that, during the day, sunshine, or where people are eating and you just have to do it and people aren't really interested in you, they're more interested in the buffet. And basically the only thing, you just push through. You just keep talking, make eye contact, keep going, keep a smile on your face. Even though they're not smiling, they can't wait for your 20 minutes or half an hour to be out. You just go, I'm getting paid to do this and I'm going to be up here for half an hour or however long I'm being, and just be a professional, do it, and thank them for their time and walk off and go, thank God that's done. But, you know, just do it. Like, you don't, you just push through.
This is great. This is so deeply ingrained in you, this sense of, you know, from very few years ago when you worked in advertising and had never even seen a live comedy gig, to now be like, you know, kind of have the sort of war horse mentality of, I'm not coming off.
No, you know what I mean? You better get into it or get on with it.
I was wondering, something I wanted to ask you was if a young comedian is listening to this and wants to be like you, what's the advice that you give them? Is that it? Just keep going.
Yeah. Well, what I,
because I mean, some might say that you haven't had to do very much keeping at it.
Yeah.
You know, you've been fairly blessed, kind of.
Yeah,
career-wise.
I've been very blessed career-wise. I've been very lucky, but it's a lot of work. You have to write a lot. Don't just go with the same crap over and over and over. Even if you've got an amazing 15 minutes, don't let that be your 15 minutes for the next 7 years. Keep writing. You know, you need to write all the time. It's hard work. And I always say, because when people just start out, they go really dirty, you know, and there's a big difference between ha 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 and ho ho ho. And I think very few people can hear that in the beginning.
Yeah. You mean
the shock laughter or the, you know, like, you have to be careful. Like I always say, if you start writing in the beginning, write about what you know because it's safe. And then you won't forget your material if you know the story. And also write stuff that you wouldn't mind your mother walking in while you're doing it. Because now you listen to rookie comics and they go, yeah, well, Louis C.K. does it. Louis C.K. is a legend. He's been through all the hard yards. He knows the rules. You can only break it if you know it. And he is a master at keeping his audience. Whereas if you go out, you don't know the rules and you just start off with real raw, rude shit, and the audience is just going to go, no. And you're going to lose them. Whereas if you do stuff that's sort of, I know it sounds terrible to say, do safe stuff in the beginning, but do safe stuff in the beginning that you know I'm in control of this.
And presumably, if you can make them roar with laughter about pencil cases,
exactly,
then that stands out in competitions as well. In the few competitions I've seen, without having been involved in them and pacing up and down, vomiting backstage,
with the sweating blood,
wanting all of my friends to fail, doing that horrible thing that it did. But the few that I've seen, it really, that's the advice I often give people if they sort of email me through the podcast, is take all the dirty stuff out because it looks naive and it looks...
Yeah.
And I had loads of dirty stuff when I started.
Yeah, because it's safe. Well, you think it is. You go, well, I've heard pro comics talk about poo or talk about kids or talk about... Don't do it.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what they know. They, you know, I think And once your audience likes you, you can get away with a lot of stuff. Like, I'm hardly a clean comic, but when I go out, I start off slow, make sure they like you, they're with you, because once they're with you, you can take them places. But it takes a while to get to that point where you understand that you and the audience, you're sort of in this ride together and you're steering it. And they'll only trust you if you don't make a mistake in the beginning. Whereas if you come out and you fumble the first 5 minutes, they're not going to trust you for the next 55 minutes.
So when you sit down to write, are you a mind maps person? Are you collecting kind of clippings of newspapers? What's the overall strategy?
You know, I mind map and I don't get up till I have a skeleton of a show. Like if I go, and I think, like, I don't get overwhelmed because I think writing is sort of such a natural thing for me. I do it all the time. So I don't, when people go, I'm going to write an hour, okay, you're setting yourself up for failure. You should write 4 15-minute shows. And make sure you've got a good segue. That's all. You just need 4 15-minute shows. Because 15 minutes is not overwhelming. You can do that. Anyone can do that. You can do that on a Wednesday afternoon at a coffee shop. So if you can write 4 15-minute bits, that's 3 segues and a good night, have a good day. And that's it. You know, like, that's all you need to do. So I mind map. And then I go, that's about 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you know, sort of so. And then I take those and I write it down.
And you're mind mapping things you care about or things you think are funny. What are those sort of starting points? Which angle do you start with the idea? Like in your latest show, you talk about apartheid, which I'm pronouncing wrongly in my anglicised way.
Yeah, you made a point of this. Yeah, your dessert way.
And it's correctly pronounced.
Apartheid.
There we are.
Yeah. A lot more angry.
Do you start with that word or that concept, or do you start with the desire to make something funny about that, or do you start with the idea of separateness and then it ends up being about
apartheid? Well, I sort of start out with, like, I just chat initially. I don't sort of reveal what the show's about right off the bat. I usually give them about 10 minutes. I just sort of get to know you kind of stuff, you know, talk a bit to them and just sort of ease them into it. And then I start with the show. But then I go, this is what the show's going to be about. And then I just start. Like, I tell them this, like, I've done a show about I'm gonna need a second opinion, which is about me surviving cancer when I was 20. So I start off with, this is I'm gonna need a second opinion, it's a medical thing. But then I start about all kinds of opinions that you get, so I sort of build up to it at the end where I'm like, but you know, I live at the end, it's about cancer, but I'm through it, that kind of thing. So,
but in terms of, I don't just mean in terms of where you start on stage.
Yeah.
In the writing, what's the genesis of each bit? If you're going, right, I'm going to sit down and do one of my 15-minute bits here.
Yeah. Oh, no, I just start, like, in the middle of the mind map, I put the title of the show, and then I go, like, I normally have one idea, sort of what I want in the show. Like, I'll normally have a little bit that I've been sort of trying out, and then I'll start with that, and then I just keep writing. Like, I don't lift the pen till the page is full.
Okay.
So if I'll do shoes, laces, and then just little plastic bits, plastic Tupperware, like I just keep going.
And then what's the next? So you've got umpteen pages with constant writing on them.
And then I just go through it and I go, plastic bits. Do I have anything that's plastic? Tits? Tits can be plastic. Do I have anything that I can say about tits? Yep. Tits are nice and round. They've got that, you know, so I sort of just keep expanding on every point.
Okay.
And then
on a selection of the points, presumably you look at some of them and go, buttons, shoelaces.
Yeah. Like tits. I cross a lot of stuff off. Okay. Like there's a lot of crap that comes out. I go, seriously, I must have smelled toast when I had this because I have no idea what that was about. Like sometimes you write stuff, you're like, what the? So no, a lot of stuff get crossed off, but then other stuff I'm like, this is genius, I'm a genius, and then, you know, I write stuff about that. But I just keep going. Like I'll just have, for every show that I'll buy 3 books. One is just me doing scribbles of the mind map. The second one is sort of setting out all the stuff. Then I go through pages of just all these mind maps. It can be about 20 pages, just words that I've scribbled and, you know, a lot of cock and balls that I draw on the page. And then
lesbians do that as well.
I know. It's a thing. If you have hands, you do it. And then the last book is sort of where I start going, okay, then I do timelines where I go, 0 to 10 minutes I'm going to do, and then I just start writing the stuff that I think, oh, that should work in there. 10 to 20, that, you know. So I sort of break it up.
And how long does the process take? You said you do it during the 2 weeks of Christchurch. Do you start with nothing and finish a fortnight later with an hour?
Yeah, well, last Christchurch Festival, I wrote the whole thing in 3 days. Because I just sat down, I had three
days. Is that the show you're doing now?
No, that's the show that I'm taking to Australia, Poise Control, that I did in New Zealand last year.
Okay.
So I sort of stagger the shows. So this show is 4 years ago.
This show you wrote 4 years ago?
Long Flight to Freedom, yeah.
Okay. So in that, like, one of the stuff you did about apartheid in the show, you said at one point that you sort of said to us, so a lot of people don't know what actually happened in 1981, and then you kind of said, these people said we're not prepared to deal with this, you go and do the research.
Yeah.
So what's your take? I wasn't quite sure whether you wanted to get your hands dirty with some political stuff.
Yeah.
Or whether that was the jumping off point for some more kind of easily acceptable observational work. Yeah. What was that about for you?
Okay, so with the 81 protests in New Zealand was the, you know, where they all protested with the rugby, with the South African team coming in. And because I start talking about apartheid at 45 minutes in. And then, because when I wrote this show, I'm like, how am I going to make apartheid funny? How's that? You know, sort of, how do you do it? And then I thought, oh, I don't really think I can. I don't really think I want to. So I just do stand-up comedy about sort of the observational stuff and, you know, difference between New Zealand and South Africa and, you know, all our dads wear short shorts. And then 45 minutes in, then I drop the apartheid thing and I call Nelson Mandela a terrorist and I sort of drop all the... And it's really quiet in the room. And for 10 minutes, it's really quiet. I don't make it funny. I just give them facts. And then, of course, I have to get them back again after that because they've been pumped. Like, I just give them all this information. And then that's why I say, well, you go read up on it. Because I do I want people to read up on it. I want people to think about it and mainly talk about it when they leave because so many people have strong opinions about it but don't actually know any facts. But I want them to go read up on it, even if they just get Nelson Mandela's book or, you know, just go Google some of the stuff around the 81 protests and actually read up. But people just know, oh, it was about rugby. Or, you know, like their impressions are very, they have no idea actually what happened. Or they are under the impression they stopped apartheid with that rugby game. Mm. And I'm like, it's almost disrespectful to say that because of so many people that lost their lives and it was so much bigger than that. I mean, I think it's amazing that people took the time and protested. I think, and I genuinely believe if there's stuff that you don't agree with and there's other people, you know, sort of the little people that can't stick up for themselves, you should make your voice heard. So the 81 protest was phenomenal, but what people took away from that was completely different than what actually happened. They walked away from one protest and went, well, we stopped it. We finished apartheid. Okay. It's like people that go, they do one comedy show and they go, tick, I'm a comedian, I've nailed comedy.
I just want to talk a little bit more about the dynamic between you as an observationalist, as a person of the people, who everyone is, who twinkles and everyone just kind of falls. They do sort of fall at your feet where they literally run up to you and hug you.
Yeah.
The dynamic, the tension between that and opinion and how much opinion there is in your show and how important it is to you to describe the world as you see it. Like, do you, I don't think I've ever heard you talk on stage about your sexuality or about, I mean, other than sort of, you know, a few jokes about it. Do you have any kind of like burning desire to tell people how you feel about stuff?
No.
It's just not one of your priorities?
No, because I mean, I enjoy those shows. I go to these shows where people have like that Adrian Truscott show. I loved it.
Yeah.
But I'm not that comic. Like, the apartheid thing, I almost felt like I needed to say something. It's sort of addressing the elephant in the room, and it was something that really bugged me, the fact that everyone's got an opinion but nobody has a clue. And I thought, I'm going to write a show about it and just sort of set a few things straight or just have people talk about it or think about it at least, you know, sort of. And there's been heaps of discussions online about it and people email me, you know, going, I've read up, or so that's amazing. But no, I'm not a message comic. I don't, like, if people leave my show and they go, that was a good laugh, like, good. If they leave and they go, oh, well, that's something to think about, I'm not, like, I don't leave you with a message. There's not a greater purpose. There's not a, I tell you funny stories, you laugh and have a wine and go home and go, we had a good night out. That's it.
So would you say you see yourself as an artist or an entertainer?
Entertainer, I guess, because I said artist this morning and my friend that's visiting laughed at me. He goes, oh, you're an artist on the South Island, are you? So I was like, no, I'm a comic. I'm an entertainer, mate. So,
yeah. And is that accurate, do you think? That suits you?
Yeah, I think so. Don't look at me like...
No, yeah. I'm just interested. That to me... I don't interview many people who go, oh, no, absolutely, entertainer.
Yeah. I think so, because you know what?
It's not that there's no struggle with that. Yeah. Normally people go, oh, I suppose I'm just sort of an entertainer. Yeah. But you're like, bang, entertainer.
No, I'm an entertainer. I've worked it out. Because you know what? I look an artist as someone that has spent years crafting whatever they do. You know, they're amazing at it, and you look at it, you know, when you leave some show and you go, wow, that to me is an artist, you know.
Do you aspire to that, though? Do you want people to come out and go, wow?
No, because I think as a comedian, people should walk out and go, that's it. Like, I don't, you know, like some comedians, I guess, can be a bit of both, you know, yeah. Like... But no, to me, I'm happy just being an entertainer. Like I say, my job, which is an amazing job, is people come out, they away from home or whatever, they're just having a good time. People come to comedy shows, in my opinion, because they want to have a good laugh. And if you can deliver that good laugh and they leave, you've done your bit, they've done their bit. What an amazing privilege to do.
So, but do you think you have to be a comedian, or is it just something you've fallen into, you've turned out you're good at it, and you might as well make some money out of it and have a laugh?
No, I love it. I think it's amazing. I think it's an amazing job, because like I said, I didn't think it was something that you could do as a job. I didn't even think that was an option. I didn't think people could make a living out of this. And out of all the things I do, from the writing to the stand-up comedy is my absolute favourite. Because you look in their eyes and they're laughing and you go, this is great. Like, it's immediate. It's, you know.
I can't rock you. I can't unsettle you. You're happy.
I am.
Get out.
I'm happy. This is phenomenal. I love this. Like, people go, is it a job? Is it a job? I don't know. It's just amazing. It's a privilege. You know? Like, people go, things are expensive these days. You know, people have kids, lives, whatever, and they go, we're going to go out, we're going to spend our entertainment money on you. It's like they're betting on you, you know. It can go either way. You, as the performer, know that. You know, if I'm having an off day or if I, you know, can't, you don't know. Like, it's a flick of the coin, you don't know. It can go anywhere, mate. But you come out and they've put their hard-earned cash and they go, you're going to be the one, we're going to have a great time tonight. And you come out, you make them laugh. They have a great time. They leave, they go, we had a great time. And in 5 years from now, they're sitting around with their friends, go, do you remember when we went to that comedy show that one year? That was amazing. So you become part of their history. You become part of their lives.
There's a huge amount of empathy from you for them.
Yeah.
You give a fuck about them.
Not everyone does.
Not everyone gives a fuck about them, yeah. Beyond... Are they making me feel good enough?
No.
I don't know where I heard this recently, but there was someone sort of said you could either look at it two ways. You could, are you a comedian? Maybe this was like a comic strip or something I saw online. Sorry if anyone knows where it's from. Email me and I'll credit it. But they said, are you in it to make them laugh, or are you in it to make them laugh at you?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Do you see the difference? Yeah. Like, is it about them or is it about you being happy because you made them happy?
Yeah, no, it's
and
about
for you,
them.
It's about them.
Yeah, yeah, because that's what I say too, because I'm not motivated by money. Like, And this frustrates the shit out of my wife, but because she's very analytical, she's very, like, we're complete polar opposites. Not that she's motivated by money, but I think she would like for me to be more, you know, sort of business orientated, which I'm not, because I look at something, I go, like, for instance, if somebody goes, will you come and do a show at a bar? And I go, yeah, sure. And they go, we'll give you $50. And I said, all right, I'll go do it. Now, to me, the minute I've agreed to do it, I've signed off on, I'm happy with the money, I'm happy with whatever. Then I rock up and there's 1,800 people. They have completely oversold the gig. There's just people everywhere. I do the gig. I go home, I say to her, this was amazing. I said, oh, I had such a good time. They had a good time. It was so good. Like, I looked out, there was tears running down. It's just mascara on this one lady's face. Okay, it was phenomenal. She, and you got $50. I go, what? Like, the $50, like, so, I don't think about the money. I just think about, am I doing a good job? Are they having a good time? They are. Success. We all go home happy. And then I get home and I'm like, oh, yeah, and I get paid for it. How amazing is this? Like, to me, it's a bonus. It's gravy.
It's the icing, not the cake.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And then she's like, they should have given you more money. And I'm like, oh, but I agree to it. Yeah, but they should have changed it. When they, the minute they oversold that first ticket, they should have said, we probably should give her a bit more. But I don't think like that. I'm like, are they, you know, it's probably, like, I'm never going to be wealthy, am I? Like, I've just heard myself, I'm never going to be wealthy.
I think you'll be fine.
Yeah, I'm never going to upgrade that 1988 Subaru that I'm driving.
We should wrap up. Thank you so much for talking to me. I feel like I would like to finish up with, like, a ComCom classic question. What would be on your comedy gravestone? What would be your final message to the world?
Here lies Ursula Carlson, New Zealand's Oprah. Like, that would be it. That would be it.
That's what you want to be?
Yeah. Well, I think I already...
Or you'd put that anyway.
Yeah, that's going on anyway. I've pre-booked it. I'm paying it off. It's on Layboy.
Why do you want to be New Zealand's Oprah?
Because why wouldn't you want to be Oprah? She's a phenomenal woman. And she's just amazing, and she does so much for the world, and she should be in charge of the entire world. And that is how it should be. Am I right? Like, yeah. So we've got one person listening to this in the theatre, and she agrees with me.
It's not the theatre, it's my hotel.
Oh, sorry, it's your hotel. Why do you sleep in the theatre? I just reckon Oprah is amazing, and I'm going to be her.
Amazing, I'm sure you are.
So thank you to Ursula. Thank you, I should say, as well, to everyone at the Christchurch World Buskers Festival. I've had such a good time here. Thank you to Tim Bain and Glenn Pickering, the director and associate director. Other way around. Glenn's in charge. Tim is very much the power behind the throne. Thanks for having me. Thanks to all the volunteers and all the people that worked here. Myself, Harley, Luke Heggie and Chris Turner all had such a wonderful time here. And there were some brilliant, brilliant shows. So thanks, guys. Thanks for having us. Thank you to Ursula for coming on the show. This episode is co-produced by Nathan Wood. And there's a strong chance that Olivia Phipps helped out with the podmin. That's all for now. I'm still on my holidays. Try not to think too hard about when in the last few weeks I recorded this, because I think I've made a reasonable job of making it sound like it's all bang up to date. That's all for now, and I'll speak to you soon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.